I'm not going to do a travelogue for our visits because that's not fair. We go on vacation, come back and tell our story. That's not what we're doing here. The occasion of the visit to Europe helps me think through things. And we're going to talk about art. Art. Not the man. The skill or whatever. The phenomenon of art. We talked about Poland last week. This week we're going to talk about Italy. I like to say just Rome. To me, Rome is all of Italy, and Italy doesn't seem to have the punch like when you say Rome, because Rome is so big, it covers all of Italy. The Roman Church does. In fact, it covers all of Poland, for that matter. I got a question for you. What arch are we looking at? Arch of Triumph? Well, okay, that's true, but of what? I thought I'd have somebody jump on this one really quick. I thought you'd say this would be the Arch of Titus. I thought that's what you'd say, but it's not. I finally got you. It's the Arch of Constantine. It's in the shadows of the Arch of Triumph, Arch of Titus. Arch of Titus is about the victory over, what part of it is victory over Jerusalem. And it was done much earlier in the first century, whereas this was done in the fourth century, 315, I think. And it commemorates Constantine's consolidation of the Western world under his hegemony. But they're in the same area, in the Roman Forum. Anyway, I just thought I might trip you on that one, but no one even bit. It's in the Roman Forum, the old city of Rome, next to the Colosseum. In fact, Colosseum is, you can see parts of it to the right if you look at the picture. And to the left is the Arch of Titus. So they're in the same area. I just regret we didn't spend more time there, as it always is when you go places. You never spend enough time there. Well, let me tell you what we're going to do here. We are in a mini-series about European history. We're not doing a travelogue. We looked at Poland last week. This week, Italy, or as I say, Rome. We mean Roman Empire, or even the Roman Catholic Church, just Rome. It's historic. Now, it is fortuitous that these two countries, and this happened to me after I got home thinking about this, that these two countries, Poland and Rome, we have represented the two people groups that have defined human history for 4,000 years. With Poland, we have the Jews. Now, they're not, the Poles are still Gentiles, but the Jews live there. They're in the diaspora. That's where they are located. Maybe as many as half of all the Jews in the world live in Poland at this time. Now, in Rome, we have the Gentiles. It's almost the Gentiles in their dominance. You have the Jews in their diaspora, in their subjugation, and we have Rome on the other side sort of personifies all that is Gentile and that is dominant. So Poland is as Gentile as Rome is, that is true, but in the Polish lands, the Jews have uniquely been given harbor since 1264. This provision has given Poland, sometimes called Russia, Lithuania, and other words, and sometimes it's partitioned, and it's never one country. They have a special consideration because they have contained the major part of the diaspora, which ended up going to Israel later on. So remember last we talked about watch the Jews, always reading the newspapers, always watch the Jews. Remember last week we said that anytime you want to understand history, watch the Jews. That is, watch what God is doing with his people. Whether it is World War I or World War II, for the Jews, each was a decisive factor, for example. Notice, too, the chaos that it was between the wars set up after World War I. And I'm watching a series now on TV. If you have Amazon Prime, you might watch it. It's called The Impossible Peace. In these 20-year period between World War I and World War II, we just don't know what goes on there, but it's an incredible period of time. And we got to keep our eyes on the Jews when we watch stuff like that. During this time, Zionism was developing. And what you're looking at on the right is the Roman Colosseum, which is built with the Jewish gold that was taken from the temple in Jerusalem 70 AD. They came back and built the Colosseum. Now, on our tour, no one told us that, which doesn't surprise me. So we have, again, have the interface between Jews and Gentiles in Rome. So today, as we look at Rome, be aware that Rome is the antithesis of the Jews, Gentiles and Jews. The opposite is traceable to Nimrod's Tower of Babel, where an opposing authority, Nimrod attempted to set up a system that would be free of the Creator God. This initial attempt failed, but the idea of a world-ruling Gentile will not disappear until we have the outcome of Revelation 18 or 19, which Gil just is going through. So on the right, we have a Roman pantheon. This pantheon means a place for all the gods, built by Hadrian around 125. And now it's a church. Now it's co-opted as a Catholic church, but it's one of the magnificent structures that you see when you go to Rome. An art piece, by the way, but a pagan art piece. In the 70 AD, Titus, the son of the Roman Emperor Vespasian, conquered Jerusalem. In the process, the temple was destroyed, the gold was taken, and built a Colosseum. The Jews lost their standing in their own land and the eyes of the world. They lost their national status back in 586, but now they lost even the subjugated status they had under the Romans. For in order for the Romans to memorialize the event, it took six legions. By the way, that 6 times 6 is 36,000, and I've even read another six legion. So there'd be 72,000 soldiers to subjugate Jerusalem. The Jews have a tenacious ability to defend themselves. It took these legions to accomplish this, and therefore an arch of triumph was built in Rome to commemorate all the work of Titus. So they could boast about their accomplishment. On the arch is a bas-relief that shows the seven-branch Jewish menorah and the Jewish wealth being carried off by the Roman as booties. Now, I don't think I brought a picture of that. But this is the arch of Titus. And the way they do this commercially, if you want to see the real good side, you got to pay money. And we didn't have time to pay money, so I walked up and took some pictures from the backside. But just notice how many people are there. I mean, that's one of the things that just was overwhelming, just the number of people that are on tour in Rome, in the all of Italy. So in Rome, in the Arch of Triumph, we have a perfect picture of the nexus. The Jewish interest, and those of the Romans. In this case, the Roman boast over the Jews is short-lived, relatively. In the end, Rome is epitomized when Babylon is utterly destroyed, never to rise again. Now, that still hasn't happened. So when I say it's quickly, we talk about 2,000 years in eternity. That's nothing. So the Arch of Constantine, I just mentioned that to you. The state and church was joined by Constantine. He was widely honored for that and sometimes cursed for it, you might say. But before that, he satisfied all his solidified all his opponents under one rule. An arch of triumph was built to him for that accomplishment. And with that accomplishment, a Christian world, quote, unquote, was made possible by joining the state and the church, because now the state can enforce the religion, and now you have everything you ever wanted as a human being, religion and force, and be able to accomplish what was great for the Christians. Falsely placed hope. So anyway, this was fulfilled in 325 AD. That's from then on you find Christians becoming prominent. They start building churches and so forth. By the way, it's the last arch to be built. On the left you see the Arch of Titus, and on the right would be the Colosseum. Okay, in Rome we have St. Peter's, the Basilica. Now we have the three people groups with Gentiles, Jews, and now the church. The Roman church and the Roman Empire, the Roman government somewhat blend together, which is understandable. We understand that because of Constantine. Here we have in Rome a visible history of the church in Rome, visible history of the church. That is the apostate version of it, or as it ends up being, the apostate version of it. Because there was a Roman church, right? What do we have in our Bible that's called the Book of Romans? So there were Christian Romans that were Christians in Rome. So if it's apostate now, something happened. So let's investigate that layer of the picture, the church as centered in Rome. Now, here's my caveat. Perhaps my next subject is bigger, and I really think this needs more work than I'm going to be able to give it today. But perhaps my next subject is bigger than our few minutes can accommodate. But think with me a bit about the art of Christianity. Now, I know there are some people say, I could care less about art. I don't have a picture in my house or whatever. That's probably not true. But people just, you know, if you don't know anything about such subject, you know, the best thing you can do to defend yourself is, I don't care about it. You don't just say, I don't know anything about it. That'd be better. But anyway, a lot of people have no interest in art. You know, it's something in a different world. You know, you think of Picasso, you know, abstract art that means nothing, whatever. You know, so you sort of reject the whole thing. But there's realistic art, so forth. So think a little bit with me about the art. Now, I'm talking about the art that's from the Renaissance, we call it 300 to 600. And then we get into the Enlightenment period, which somewhat follows that. And I'm going to include art and architecture, sculpture, anything that has to do with the creativity of man to represent something. Now, we venture to say this is a difficult subject for most of us. That is, how should we react to this art? The obvious creative genius. Well, we have one option. Do we see all these things, the expression of the works of the devil, meant only to distract us, divert us from the truth of the word, or is there some value in these magnificent accomplishments? And if that's so, which is my option, if so, what value can be prescribed? It says, how does that fit into my Christian life or thinking? Well, we have some headwind here because during the Renaissance, we have man is the measure of all things, sort of promotes man as the center of things rather than God, which is the shift in the Renaissance. Appreciating the art produced in the time of the Renaissance and Enlightenment is difficult by the motto of this time, man is the measure of all things. Now, we have Michelangelo's statue of David, and I forgot, I thought it was 8 foot tall, but it's 17 feet tall, which probably includes the pedestal. You look at the size of the people that are standing around it, and three times that height would get you about 17 feet with the entire figure. So when you look at Michelangelo and you look at it, can anything good come out of this? And maybe Michelangelo is not a good example of art, although it is art, but constructive art, because Michelangelo was commissioned to do David, which is the biblical figure, presumptively. In killing Goliath, he's got his, you know, eye fixed on his enemy and his rocks in his hands and is ready to do battle with him. But what we're really representing to Michelangelo, he did it for the Woolen Guild, a commissioned art piece. But what he's really saying here is that man, perfect man, is the ideal, and that's where we're going. Now, we don't agree with that. So you see, we're going to get into art. We can have stuff that we can agree with, and we have art that we don't agree with. So with Dave, we'd probably have an art piece that says, well, that's what they're saying. That's one thing. But if we're just looking at the magnificence of the skill to create this piece of art out of a piece of marble, it's really quite incredible. And he did it in less than 2 years, and he was 28 years old. Now, the Enlightenment period, a little bit later, come overlap here, 1600 to 1800, followed the Renaissance. Enlightenment is the mind now can see things, it reasons things. So when reason becomes the primary source of authority and legitimacy, that's what Enlightenment is. The Enlightenment came to advocate ideals of like liberty, human progress, and even human goodness. It was during this time that the common sense, 1776, our nation was built on common sense ideology coming from man, and it was considered the source of authority here. Heretofore, it had been the Bible, we might say the Pope, but really the Bible was the authority. Even the Pope supposedly submitted to the Bible. So with all this negativity, is it possible to sort out the motives of these great works of art, architecture, and science? Is that possible? So why do art anyway? As today, it is not ever easy to prescribe motivation to the accomplishment of greatness. You know, when somebody does something great, you don't know why they did it. So why did it for the money? Well, it may be. Maybe they did it for the fame. Well, maybe. You don't really know. You know, sometimes people do things we don't really understand or don't have to know why. In the case of architecture, the Renaissance works took centuries to complete and cannot represent one person, but represent multiple generations, a conglomeration of people to complete a cathedral. So we can't say this one person had this wrong motivation or right motivation to do this thing. It was a sociological motivated thing. Everybody grouped together to do this event. You just couldn't get it done in one generation. Now, of course, there were exceptions, like I say, with Michelangelo and Leonardo da Vinci, who their works were personal. So we have on the right, St. Mark's Cathedral is basilica, actually, is in Venice, started in 978, completed a little over 100 years later. A little over 100 years later. Now, St. Mark's is named St. Mark's because of Mark's association with Peter in Rome. So we're in Italy, but we're not in Rome. And there was no evidence that Mark ever was here, but that doesn't keep anybody from naming it Mark. And this is a piece, I have these places noted on the map over there, the so-called map. So why do art? So knowing we cannot ascribe true motivation, what can we can only say, here's the punchline. Why do we do art? All we can say is that in Christianity, in all its forms, it inspires the artistic or creative genius like no other religion known to man. So Christianity stands above all other religions in producing these works of art. Why is that? Maybe that's the question. Excuse me. You go to any other religion and look at what they've done with it. You go to Buddha, all they can do is make another big Buddha. Maybe make a bigger Buddha. Maybe you make a shed to protect the Buddha. And you just don't have it. You just don't have it anywhere. But in Christianity, you go, and we've been a lot of places in the world, wherever we go, especially where there's Catholicism, they've built buildings and they have works of art that are incredible. And most, I've told you this four times. St. Petersburg is the best place I've ever been for art in Russia. But it's built on Christian basis. Okay, so why is this inspiration there? So I say in Christianity, in all its forms of Christianity, it inspires the artistic and creative genius like no other religion known to man. Why is this? Why? Okay. As for Christian theology, it has little in common with most religious thinking. It belongs to a sophisticated, high, rational discipline that is fully developed only in Christianity. Only in Christianity is there any development of theology. And when you develop theology, it gets expressed in all kinds of ways. Art is only one. Science is going to be another one. Sometimes described as a science of faith, theology consists of formal reasoning about God. Now, I'm not talking about rationalism here. I mean, our church teaches a reasonable faith. You can think when the man preaches here that it makes sense. That's reasoning, all right? Not from nothing. It's reasoning from Scripture. The emphasis is on discovering God's nature. And this is in Christianity and Christian theology. The emphasis is on discovering God's nature, his intentions and demands, and understanding how these define the relationship between the human being and God. That's nowhere else except in the Scripture and in Christianity. The gods of polytheism cannot sustain theology. They cannot write about their God. In fact, Islam condemns doing it because they are far too inconsequential. They have no power. They make no difference. There are no great artistic works or grand achievements in polytheism. Now, you might say these totem poles with these gods on them, but, you know, that's a minor thing that's done compared to what you see with Christianity. So in Christian theology, necessitates an image of God as a conscious, rational, supernatural being of unlimited power and scope who cares about humans and imposes moral codes and responsibilities upon them. And I might improve on that a little bit, but that's generally the idea. Whereby generating serious intellectual questions about God or about us. Just one example, why does God allow us to sin? I mean, that's a good question. It's a big question. Do you think that Islam asked that question or Buddha asked that question and didn't even recognize it as sin? So it's only in Christianity where these inquiries actually are allowed and encouraged because the God we serve is so consequential. He is there and he makes a difference. Now, to the extent that religion inspires efforts to comprehend God's work, knowledge will be forthcoming. In other words, the more you study, the more you understand. The more you understand, the more you study. And because to comprehend something fully, it is necessary to explain it, science arises as the handmaiden of theology. So science helps explain God, because God made things, so what is made explains the Creator. That's all I said about the little baby's finger. You know, that traces me back not to luck. It traces me back to this consequential God who made it and who cares for this little child to be born into our family whole, healthy, and ready to serve a whole life. You know, whatever the plan would be, God has for it. It's not just some luck chance. We have no idea what's going on. We have fully connected this event with God. And that's precisely how those who took part of the great achievements of the 16th and 17th century saw themselves as pursuing the secrets of the creation. That's what science does, true science does. So we have in this category Newton, Kepler, and Galileo regarded the creation itself as a book. They call it sometimes the second book. So as with the science, so with the art. The artists of the Renaissance have the idea that God is consequential. They have to deal with him. That whatever it takes to explain him in art is worth all their best efforts. The scenes from the Bible are clearly legible because they read their Bibles literally and represented those accounts to the public for their instruction in their churches. I didn't take a picture of this. I had so many things I could take pictures. I took 4,000 pictures. It wasn't enough. But there's a picture, this is the whole trip, but there's a picture of Noah and his drunken stupidity laying, you know, on the back. And we have two brothers having a blanket or whatever, covering, walking towards him to cover him up. This is in this mosaic. And one brother off the edge scoffing at what he's doing. Is that a biblical account? Yes, it is. And I'm standing there, and look, that's what that is. There's no doubt of what this is. That's Noah. These are the sons, and these are good sons, these are the bad sons, all right? So there is something happening. Why did these people stop to do this? Well, there was something that needed to be preserved in the minds of people. People didn't have Bibles, so they put these things on the walls of their churches. So scenes of the Bible are clearly legible. I understood exactly what it was. And by the way, the thing that was so marvelous about it was a mosaic, and the pieces were so small that, you know, you didn't even know which, you know, quarter inch by quarter inch, I'm saying in a distance, and it looks like a painting. And you have to have all these different colors of shades that you have to glaze, and you have to fire, and you have to, you know, make chips out of, and put them up. I mean, it's a huge undertaking, and we're only talking about one picture. It's probably 20 by 15. I mean, relatively small. So the scenes of the Bible are clearly legible because they read their Bibles literally. That's important here. They read their Bibles literally, just like we do. This is the real Noah, and these are his three sons. And they represent the account to the public for their instructions. No other religion has this kind of grip on the people. No other religion has this kind of grip on all the people. No other religion has a God who requires this kind of inquiry. I'm standing there, and I'm thinking of these other people with me are probably believers. So do you understand what you're looking at? What a place to start to explain what's going on here. So it must be added that this altruism does not last, you know, where they portray the Bible's truths, and that's all they do. Perhaps it was never there. I don't know. We're not judging motives here. Since other subjects and other objects find their way into the arcades of art as imposters, and you'll see them all over, so now we find not only the churches dedicated to Mother Mary, and they're all called dedicated to Mother Mary, and the crypts are filled with saints offering intercession, but remember that this is a corruption of Christian theology. The motivation to tell these stories may still be pure. How do I know? They're still up there. They haven't chipped them off the wall. They're still up there. So they're, in one way, I've thought about this, we may say all these cathedrals in Europe and they're pagan, they're so full of Mary and whatever, but on the other hand, they are witnesses to something. It's like going to a graveyard and you see a gravestone. We know that the gravestone represents a body there. So the churches represent the gravestone and there's a body buried here. Maybe we should find out who the body is. All right, so how do we assess this phenomenon of the art of the Renaissance? You know, I know that Zwingli, and I'm not sure I would have done anything else, but when he turned from Catholicism to the Reformed religion, as they call it, he went to his church and he cleaned every icon and every picture and he whitewashed the place. And it's a regret to all the people since then because all the art's gone. So that's one reaction. Get rid of all of it. It's distracting. It's misleading. So, you know, that's not our day and we're in our day. So today, what do? Do we load it up, haul it to the garbage dump, throw it away as a waste of time? Or is there another way to appreciate it in a way that doesn't corrupt us? So I want to show you some things that are magnificent. This is just a hallway leading to the Sistine Chapel. Look at the ceiling. I can't stop and talk about it. This is in the St. Peter's Basilica. This is in the rotunda, the round part. In the bottom of the round part where St. Peter's body is, quote, quote. And this is the altar. This is the highest place you can go in Rome, in Roman Catholicism. This is Mother Church. It was designed by no other than Michelangelo. He got into all kinds of things. We have the Pietà, which is the body of Christ, the dead body of Christ laying in his mother holding it. Of course, a very Catholic feeling to all this, but it's a reality. It could well be this happened. No big deal. It's now behind glass because it was attacked, remember, some years ago. Now, again, a little closer shot of this rotunda, the place where the body is, and the ceiling is just full of artwork. And I can't stop to explain them all, and some of them were probably good, some probably were bad. You know, some were added later outside of St. Peter's Basilica. We see it all the time. We see it out in the courtyard. And the obelisk from Egypt, there's four of those in the world. One of them's here, one of them's in Istanbul, and I don't know where the two are. And now we're back to St. Mark's and St. Venice. Venice is up here at the top. You know, it's a city offshore. I didn't know I'd enjoy that as much as I did. But we have the mosaics again over the doorway. This is a Venetian. You see a much different architecture, much more lacy, much more delicate, not Rococo or what we call it, Baroque. It's just different. We call it Venetian. You know, it's kind of like from Venice. So anything you see in Venice is Venetian, right? All right. Okay, that's good. And I just, you know, take pictures as we walk by. Don't have time for anything. St. Mark Basilica at the end, and then we have the Renaissance Bell Tower on the right. I'm just showing you there's some wonderful pieces of art there. There's an architecture. This is Pisa. We call it the Leaning Tower of Pisa. This is the place where there's a graveyard for people that returned from the Crusades where they were buried. So this is built up around that. So the Pisa Tower is the Bell Tower. It's leaning. Okay, you know, it's leaning because in the construction it started to tip. And they didn't quit building on it. They just tried to straighten it up. So by the time you get to the top floor is pretty straight. So, you know, you never want to give one. You know, that's one of those things you want to throw good money after bad. You know, if it's starting to go, just keep throwing money at it.
But that middle one is the church.
Yeah, it's the church, right. And then what you see in the front is called the baptistry. All right. And behind to the left, yet, is the burial grounds. Now we'll go to Florence, which is the competitor to Rome. And again, you see the mosaics, and very, very ornate, different than what you see in the cathedrals in Europe. I'm just pointing to you, there's art. And there's people who made a tremendous effort to do something representing something. You know, whether it's, in some cases, saints, some cases, you know, apostles. It's the Tower of Florence. That's the picture, you know, the dome. See that a lot. Then we go another place to Siena. I'm just running through quickly. A church that was started and never was completed because it ran out of money. Nothing new. And now we go to Siena. That's spelled right. Another church of Mary. Very Florentine or Venetian. And again, the lacy work. You don't see that in Europe. All right. Then we have a little bit of Michelangelo here. We've got to do this quickly. The genius man. I mean, I don't know. I guess if Adam was smart, Michelangelo might have looked kind of dumb against him. But Michelangelo is so smart. I mean, maybe he was not smart in his life, but he was smart in his gift. And he lived to be 89 years old. So he's got to be an old person, and that means he could do a lot of work. So the genius of geniuses, before doing David, he worked on six separate sculptures at one time. never finished any. Four of these are now displayed at Florence, and I have five here, so one of these is an imposter, and I don't know which one it is. Four of these are on display at Florence. He worked without models, totally from memory. Now, if you ever done any artwork, if you're trying to draw somebody's face or form without even looking at something, you got to really be pretty good, and you probably have practiced a lot. People that do cartoons, they didn't start that by just doing it. They practiced at it. So you have Michelangelo taking a figure that he has in his mind and taking a piece of block and just carving it out, and we have incomplete figures here, but you see what they're doing. You know, you see the muscles in the arm. You sometimes even see the blood vessels in the arm and exactly the way the anatomy is worked, which I understand he worked with anatomy, with cadavers. So he understood it, but to have that in your mind, it's not like they looked at a picture or looked at a model person and he copied that. It was in his mind. If you don't understand how hard that is, try it sometime. And those of you that are somewhat artists, you don't understand how it helps a lot to know what you're looking at, to draw it. So I'm not going to explain who these are. So these are the works of Michelangelo. And then we have the Sistine Chapel, which is probably enhanced here in color. It's not that bright. But we have all the stories of the Bible up there. And we have one in the middle that we know that we'll show at the end with her. In the middle here is God and man touching each other. And that's sort of, that they never quite touch. And then we have Michelangelo's The Last Judgment. I'm hurrying here. This needs to be looked at and talked about, because in this, Michelangelo sees himself. Okay, on your right, you see people going to hell. They're coming up out of the grave, and you see the river Styx in the middle. That's a little Greek mythology here. The river Styx in the middle at the bottom. You see it here? Okay, here's the river. And over here, these people coming out of the grave, and they're going to heaven. These are the good people, quote, quote. And these are the people coming out of the grave, and they're going to hell. Well, where does Michelangelo paint himself? Well, he paints himself with the bad people. See, here he is. He's totally stripped of all his bones and his innards. All he has is his skin, and he's hanging by the hand of Moses, probably, on his way to hell. So we have Michelangelo somewhat understanding his precarious position. But he does this art, because there's a reality to it. Perverted, perhaps. So maybe Michelangelo has insight into his real condition. He might well be on a work system, truly, trying to extricate himself from hell by his fabulous works. This may motivate others to their work. But none of this takes away that God, takes away the God who is consequential in the end. So all of these works of art know that at the end of the road there is a God they're going to have to answer to. You don't have that in other religions. And then it inspires art to explain this? What a wonderful place to start, by the way. Okay. Blinding yet seeing something. Finally, we can think about all this in terms of Romans chapter 1. They know about God, even may try to make peace with him by their own efforts. Perhaps it's like driving our automobile headlights at night. They shine only so far, but beyond that there is more reality. But they are unaware of this more reality. So it's likely that these great artists lived only in the light of their headlights, but what they could see, but they never saw the completed truth as in the light of day. But they recognized, as right Michelangelo did, that someday there would be an accounting. So appreciate their genius and realize that it takes more than that to be reconciled to God. Even here, Michelangelo recognized the need for God's touch, but put too much hope in his ability, perhaps. Yet he puts himself on the side of going to hell, so obviously his ability didn't work. Yet he finds himself in hell. So Rome leaves us with a great void. The system as it has been corrupted will be destroyed with the false prophet, as Revelation says. So I thought, as I sat on the bus with people full of mostly Catholic people, I thought, what is it that I can say to these people as we visited church after church after church? What can I say to you people that are Catholics that would be some help? And it was occurred to me that there are never done. We are never done. The Catholic is never done. The Roman system is never satisfied, nor can it say your salvation is completed. There's always one more thing you need to do. It wasn't quite enough. And I can stand and say it is finished. The debt has been fully paid, and that's the difference. And I don't think our artists, by and large, understood this, and they went on still to honor the Creator God, who they thought somehow would be appeased by what they did. But it doesn't take away the fact of what they did and how important it is or how accurately it portrayed the Bible truth. That's only Bible some people ever saw. My point is that only in Christianity is God consequential. I said all forms of it. Even just think about this. Even the watered-down version of it inspires. Even the watered-down version of it inspires. Well, I know. I understand what you're saying. But in the broad stroke of things, these representations of Christian art, Christian truth, fit somehow within Christianity. It's not Muslim. Well, all I'm doing here is to be careful what I'm being represented here. I say just to stop and appreciate the motivation behind these works of art. There is a God that is consequential, and they're responding to it. Now they're responding to it in appropriately or inadequately, but they are responding to it. The God that they're honoring is there. They can't escape him. And you're right. Everywhere Christianity has been, there has been some effort, wrong in many cases, to represent him or to show that he exists or show that he has power or influence. You know, they put the cathedrals on the top of the hills in the towns and put a cross on top. They do everything they can to elevate God. And I'm agreeing they're not doing the right way. But the motivation behind it, they understand there's a God they have to face. Right. So I'm trying to allow you to go to these cathedrals and not curse them.
I admire them.
You know, exactly. Why?
Because they're beautiful.
More than that.
Well, they tell a story.
And the story is there is a God and he's consequential. Michelangelo has this painting of the Last Judgment. I mean, he was serious. I know that's why we go and explain it to them. That is what it is with art. Art doesn't tell the whole story. It's like seeing little bigger baby's fingers. That doesn't tell the whole story. That's my foot in to tell the story. Yeah, you can't come to Christ by looking at art. I don't think you could. Maybe you can. I don't know. You have to have information. So, yeah. Remember, the same premise underlies all this. There is a God that is consequential. Understand what I'm saying with that? What God is consequential? I mean, we have to deal with him. You cannot walk away from him, and he has something to do with this world. We're not just, you know, leaves being blown by the wind. There is a relationship between God. He cares for us. He cares for humanity. He sent his own son. This is the God we're talking about. He is consequential. And there are efforts, benign efforts and wrong efforts, to try to represent him. But the motivation behind this, I think, in the altruistic sense, is that they want to represent him. They have to acknowledge that he is there. Did I say hand over here? Yeah, Carol. So, you know, as there is with so many things, you never can ever say anything emphatically that doesn't need to be explained a little bit.
It can require a lot of thought.
Right? We have a reasonable religion, though. It's something you can think about. You can think about it, you know. We're not a mindless, benign blob. We can think about it. And God, and then we all of a sudden recognize God has a benevolent concern for his creation. Look what he does to take care of it. So it leads me to the Creator God. It should. Now, we have others that just, what's this? And I'm going home for a source of a beer. You know, can't help those people. I'm just saying, when you go, and I hear this, some people say, well, that's just a bunch of cathedrals, and I didn't. I understand that. But why did those cathedrals get built? Because somebody thought there was a God that was consequential. They needed to do something. And I know it was misunderstood that they got to do something for God. I don't know. Another thing we have a problem with the Catholic Church is that the Catholic Church has changed over the years. It isn't like it was in the beginning. From the Council of Trent, 1555, it's different. Now, I don't want to give any space to the Catholic Church that we're not beat it. It shouldn't be, but Staupitz was one of the major influences in Luther's coming to faith, and he was an evangelical in the Catholic Church, and he never left it. So we do have to recognize that, at least at that time and before, there were people in the Catholic Church. I don't know what they believed, you know, but if they were believers, they had to believe what we believe. So I don't want to say, well, the way the Catholic Church stays the way it's always been from 500 A.D. Or from 300. That's not true. So we're judging it at the end. And I think that there were many believers in these Middle Ages that lived with the church and didn't like what they saw, but that was all there was, so they went to it. I'm not going to give anybody an excuse when they stand before the judgment seat, but I just don't want to be too critical of people, our forebears, when we have better insight than they did. Now, you're talking about today's Catholics. Yeah, but remember, Catholicism didn't start yesterday.
What the priest tells.
Yeah, that wasn't always that way. The priest has not been infallible since the beginning. That's an invention. A late invention. In fact, it wasn't too many centuries ago where that came up. So I guess I'm saying, I'm not pleading for the Catholic Church, obviously. There's so many problems with it, but look at it carefully. Look at it wisely. And when you see works of art that represent what the Bible said, either got to back your pickup truck to it and throw it to the dump, or you got to appreciate for what it is. Yeah, and I remember my focus this morning is on the art. I'm not saying here that once you go to these places, you get saved. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, what's the motivation for these people to do this? That's what I'm asking. And I say, only in Christianity is this kind of motivation. It doesn't exist anywhere else. Amen.